The Tom Woods Show, episode 624.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Friends, if you don't have the time of your life aboard the Contra Cruise in October 2016, then what can I say? I owe you a Coke. Bob Murphy and I are hosting a cruise that's going to be full of fun and games and music and fellowship and making new friends. A ton of fun. ContraCruise.com. Welcome, everybody. What an episode we have today. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable because guess who's joining us today? John Beza. John is a retired police detective from the New York Police Department, where he worked for over 20 years. But for our purposes, the significant thing is that he was director of security for the Ron Paul 2012 presidential campaign. And man, does he have stories. So we're going to talk about some of those stories today. I am so thrilled to be able to do this. I also want to just say, by the way, a thank you. I'm so pleased at how many thousands of people every single day tune in to the Tom Woods Show to get their daily dose of libertarianism. And I'm trying to bring on guests who, well, frankly, enrich your life, because they certainly enrich mine. And I really hope you enjoy this conversation. I can't see how you couldn't. There's no way this could possibly be bad. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here, Tom.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little something about your own background and end that story up with how it is that you came to be contacted by, I guess, contacted by the Ron Paul people, or did you talk to them? Tell us that at the end of your story.
Okay. Well, I started off young, 18 years old, as a New York State correction officer, jail guard at Sing Sing, the maximum security prison. And then after about 2.5 years there, I went to the NYPD, where I worked on Harlem. I worked in narcotics. I worked in patrol. And eventually I ended up in the Special Victim Squad, which is rape and sexual assault, et cetera. And then I retired. And I did some consulting, and I came upon Ron Paul in the 2008 campaign, and I joined Campaign for Liberty, and a couple people there knew that I was a detective, and I guess there weren't too many detectives that were members of Campaign for Liberty or police officers, so, I happened to be friends with somebody who was became a deputy campaign manager, and they asked me if I wanted to come on, and my answer was, hold on, let me think about it. Yes. And that's exactly how I answered them. So that's how I really became part of the Ron Paul team, and actually now the Ron Paul family.
Well, how about that? All right. Now, there's so many things to ask you because I know some of these stories and they're just great. But first of all, is this 2012 we're talking about, or 2008, or both?
2012 only. Yeah, 2012.
Okay. And how many months are we talking about that you were actively doing this?
15 months total, Tom.
Wow. So were you traveling all over the place?
Yes, constantly. I was never home. I had to have somebody cut my lawn for me, because I was away for so long. But I didn't mind it one bit.
You know, I saw you on TV all the time. from one event or another, I'd say, there's John on TV.
Well, I would say if you didn't see me, then I might not be doing my job.
Because yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. But it was still neat to actually see you. All right. So tell me about your first day on the job. I mean, what's it like being Ron Paul's bodyguard?
Well, I took about 15 trips from the hotel to the airport where I was going to pick him up. So I made sure I wouldn't get lost at all. And of course, I had my little directional thing up there. And when I picked Ron up, and they got in the back seat, him and Carol, and I would never call Ron or Carol. We'd call him Sir or Mrs. Paul. But anyway, when they got in the back seat, I took them over to one of the first LPACs in New Orleans. And when we went there, of course, I was kind of nervous, but I was with him, and we went through some crowds at the different, where he was making some speeches and some private briefings. But then when we went outside to the big crowd, which is across the street, there was a bar and they had an outside area. Hundreds upon hundreds of people were there, and I was there by myself now. I was alone and amongst hundreds of people with Ron, and some of his staff were there. And as we walked into the bar, I said, I think we should stop here. And I guess nobody really heard me, and he kept walking on. We walked outside, and there was literally no way out. So I let one of the staffers know. I said, you know, when time comes, somebody's going to have to stay here. I'm going to have to jump over the fence, get the car, which was parked illegally at the time, and I was hoping it wasn't towed, and pull the car up and get it to near – there was a little fence opening where we could get Ron out. But it wasn't in a bad way that we had to get him out. It was just because it was, you know, time he had to get on a plane. But it was just and I thought to myself at the time, I love this, but what am I got myself into? Yeah. I'm by myself with hundreds of people around,
yeah.
You know, and this is the Mr. Liberty here. So and at the he's always my hero, but at the time I'm like, it's surreal. The whole thing was surreal, actually.
Before you get into the super duper like funny and cute stories, I do want to ask you: was there ever a time when you felt like there was really the possibility of danger?
Not to Ron himself, to some of the campaign staff. And that was taken care of by me and the local police, but not to Ron or Carol or the family members. No, not at all.
Okay, that's good. So you got to see him up close for quite a while. I mean, as you say, a 15-month period. And one thing when you were emailing us that I liked was that he doesn't use curse words. So he has his own kind of ways of indicating his either his displeasure or confusion. So give me a few of these.
Yeah, a couple of these is sometimes when he wouldn't know what was going on because none of us knew what was going on. He would say, "What in the blazes?"
or
"What in the thunder?" And then really when something was really bad, the worst word was despicable. This is despicable. And I think we heard that once or twice at the RNC later on. But despicable was one of those words. So we all, there were three of us that kind of eventually worked together. We all kind of said, well, we don't even want to know what he means by those words. We know what they meant. They were that's the way he cursed. What in the blazes? What in the thunder? And it was funny, and it really was. But at the time, of course, we didn't laugh, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, of course, right. So as he's moving around from place to place, is he at work? Is he reading? Is he chit-chatting with everybody? What's he doing?
Constantly working, reading. He would always check on his iPad. He would always check Lou Rockwell in the Daily Paul. I could take a peek at him. I usually sat in front of the car, but I could take a peek in the back and take a look. And he would always check both of those every day, and then he would be reading a book. And every book that he read on that campaign that I saw him, that he had, I would go out and get. I'd get it on Amazon, online. I'd order it to my.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to read them until I got back, but you know, he was reading. Ricketts, Currency Wars, I think was one of.
Oh, the Currency Wars book. Yes.
That was one of them. But there were numerous, he was always reading, always, he reminds me of you, Tom. always doing something, to up everybody else's IQ and his own IQ as well. I mean.
Ah, that's great. That's great. Now, in 2012, he was attracting, he attracted some big crowds in 2008, but they were swamped by the ones in 2012. So, again, you're dealing with thousands of people now. Were you still the only person on staff in charge of security, or would they have security at the various facilities? What happened?
Well, what happened was eventually we had a advanced guy, which was a tall guy. If you saw him in the pictures, his name is Jonathan Schaefer. Wonderful guy, big Ron Paul supporter. And another guy, Will Gallagher, was a New York cop. And, of course, Ron Paul lover as well, loved Ron Paul. And eventually all three of us got together. But we were dealing with crowds where, let's say you would have a crowd of 9,000 we had one time at Berkeley, 9,500, something like that. If the Secret Service were there, because I asked their guys, they would have 150, maybe 200 people working around the crowds and doing shift work and all kinds of advance work. And we would fly in, and towards the end of the campaign, we would fly in and literally drive right to the location. And, luckily we had some good people on the ground there our Ron Paul, like Yale people, Ed King and Ani DeGroote. They were great. They would set us up. But I'll tell you, it was thousands of people and it was three of us. And we didn't do shifts. We didn't have shift work. Ron worked harder than all of us. But it was a very difficult time to and also dealing with the police, Tom, to get these things done. It was of no help that I was a retired detective from New York. I thought that was going to be a help, but certainly it wasn't. And it was certainly not a help to be with the Ron Paul campaign early on. They treated us, you know, like secondhand citizens. But what it did was use my, I'm kind of joking here, my amazing interview skills. And I said, let me use those skills towards these, cops we talked to, campus cops, a lot of them are campus police. So what I would do basically is, I would tell them, listen, we want to pull in and we want to have the door shut behind us. That would be ideal. We always like to do that. They would say, no, we want you to do this. So what I would do is be very nice. And as we approach within 5 minutes, I'd call up and say, okay, we're going to come in through that door and then you're going to close it behind us because that was a great idea you gave us. And I'd give them all the credit for an idea that I obviously was my idea, but I made them feel, I just made them feel like it was their idea. And sure enough, it worked it was smooth every time. So I guess that works. I always show deference to them, and you always, I kind of knew how to handle cops. I didn't want to act like this big, tough New York cop because it wasn't going to get me anywhere.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't have played well. Yeah, that's actually an interesting point. Now, it's true that you're probably not necessarily dealing with a lot of dangerous people, but you might be dealing with the occasional odd person.
Yes.
I mean, I can't imagine there'd be an odd person in our circles, but once in a while, one creeps in. How about any of those? Like, for example, wasn't there a story of a guy who he either wanted to or tried to kiss Ron full on the lips?
Yes. Yes, Tom. Let me tell you about that story.
Please do tell me about that story.
Oh, it's so interesting. It happened yesterday. But we're in Philadelphia, and there was one of the fundraisers, and you got to come up and take a photo with Ron. And I usually would work the photo line, and you do a couple jobs at the same time, but I'm close to him, very close to Ron. So as people would come up, I'd greet them, and we'd always be polite. That's one thing I want to just tell you right now. The team was very, very polite. We never had any problems with anybody, and any anger, any issues like that, zero. But when people would come up, so this guy would come up to me, and he was in line to go next, and he said, I'd like to kiss Dr. Paul on the lips. And I said, well, sir, I said, that's really not going to happen, I don't think. So I said it just like that. I said, then he said to me, well, how about if I kiss him on the cheek? And I said, sir, I think a real firm handshake would be really good. And he goes, I agree with you. And then he went on. Sure enough, he shook his hand. I think he knew better not to. I think Ron would have taken care of the problem, but I just, wanted to make sure that, you gave him a handshake. But that was a very interesting person. Let's put it that way.
All right. That's the first time I think I've ever actually clapped on the show. Like I just – because the way you handled that, what you said was just right. I think a good firm handshake is what the situation calls for here.
Exactly.
All right. I have to say I am a little curious about the debates because I think that's when I really saw you on TV. During the commercial breaks, I'd see you, or afterward, I'd see you. So you must have been able – if you have access to him, you must have been backstage. You must have overheard things or seen things or seen the candidates interact when they're off camera. Was any of that especially memorable?
Yes, of course. I mean – it's obviously memorable. Here I am all of a sudden in my life. I'm behind the stage and I'm on stage and so forth. But behind stage, it was interesting to see the different candidates because we did 22 debates, I think I was at. I mean, that was an awful lot of debates compared to nowadays, And, I remember one time Rick Perry, who was often very gregarious, he came in and he said John Huntsman had been in the front of the line. And Rick Perry had come in, they lined them all up, ready to walk out onto the stage. And I'm standing next to Ron. Now, a lot of security guys wouldn't do that, but I took my job seriously. I want to, I'm next to him. Nothing's going to happen. So Rick Perry comes in and he's like, Huntsman, bro, how you doing? And he reaches over, and pats him on the shoulder. He's like, Doc, how you doing? And I was just, Rick Perry was an extremely gregarious guy.
That's
I'm not
funny.
Saying, we all know, what.
Yeah, his, right. Yeah, 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 right.
I'm a Ron Paul supporter, okay? So people should know that. Rick Perry, some of the people, I tend to try to, when Ron has changed, I tend to try not to, I won't badmouth anybody, but I will say some of the more negative people were like a Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum. they weren't very friendly towards Ron. I mean, Ron could speak for himself, but I never saw that. But I did see Rick Perry, of all people. You know, we had that one incident we could talk about at some point, but Rick Perry was the one who's always very, very congenial, if you will, at least backstage.
Yeah, yeah. How about that? All right. So that is interesting. I had the sense that Ron kind of got along with at least a couple of them. I even had the sense that he might have sort of gotten on okay with Mitt Romney.
You would be right. You'd be right to say that. They had a personal relationship that, you know, I won't get into. Ron obviously would get into that. But there was a time where Ron's plane broke down somewhere. I forget where it was on the trail. And Mitt had, offered to let him use his plane or stay at their house overnight. And I think what it was I think that Carol and Mitt Romney's wife, I forget what her name was.
Ann Romney, yes.
And they were friendly. And I think that brought Ron and Mitt just a tiny bit together, and they seemed friendly, but not overly, you know.
Oh, no, yeah, no, I get it. Yeah. I get it. You know, but something you said a minute ago about negativity and you know, you're trying to learn from Ron. I know, again, from something that you said in the email that Ron didn't really like when people would he wasn't interested in personal attacks. That he really, really kept things on a really high level. He wanted to take the high road. And that even applied to things that he would sign or not sign that people might present to him.
That is correct. Yeah, you're right, Tom. If somebody came up to him, first of all, he would not sign your skin. He would just say, nicely. Ron was always nice. That's another thing. He was never grouchy or anything. He was always nice. There's nothing negative to say, you know, about this. But Ron would say, you know, I'm not going to sign a skin. I'll sign something else, you know, and very nicely. And some people would come up with the Obama like posters or whatever, and had him look like the Joker, you know, and from Batman.
Yeah.
And he just wouldn't sign it. He would just, you know, kind of just put his hand off, and he would sign something else. I mean, he was very, very polite about it, but there were certain things that he wouldn't do, and he would not. He was very. I hate the word is kind of silly, but non-negative about the other candidates in person too. I mean, afterwards as well. I mean, there was nothing, you know, that, you know, no bad mouthing of candidates that I heard.
All right. I'm curious about first of all, before we get to the Republican convention, let's talk about, I love this story of the couple at the side of the road holding Ron Paul signs, and you guys drive by. You got Ron in the car. And you drive by this couple. Tell that story. I love this story.
Okay, this was in the middle. I think it was in Michigan somewhere. It's all a blur to me sometimes, you know. But Jonathan and Will might remember the date or the location. But anyway, it was cold out, and I think it was in Michigan. And we were from one event to another. And in the middle of like what I would consider nowhere, you know, I'm from New York, but I consider it middle of nowhere, was a couple holding a Ron, I think they were a married couple, holding a Ron Paul 2012 sign. And they were standing on the corner, and, you know, some people were, you know, beeping. And I tapped my partner, Jonathan Schaefer. He was our driver. And I said, Jonathan, pull over here. And, you know, I made a command decision, you know, because I remember me being out there holding those signs. So we pulled over, and I rolled my window down, and I said, and then we had dark windows, so they couldn't see inside. So I said, I put my window down, and I said, who is this Ron Paul guy? You know, turning into a joke eventually. I said, who is this Ron Paul guy? And they're like, oh, he's the greatest. And I said, does he look like anything like this guy back here? And he rolled his window down, and there's Ron. And you should have seen the faces on these people.
Oh, I wish I could have.
And Tom, he signed the autographs on, I think, on their signs. And it was, I love telling the story because it was a great story. And, you know, and Ron loves that. And I would never do anything, pull over or anything, if I knew that Ron wouldn't like that. But, you know, he liked that. He got a kick out of it. So
I bet he did. That is so awesome. Yes. All right. Then I do want to say, now I realize there'll be some things I don't expect you to tell me what's going on in the back of his mind or anything like that.
Right.
But just your own experience at the Republican convention. Let's first pause for a quick message. Folks, let me tell you something. I love watching somebody do something he is a master at. Whether it's a master magician at work, whether it's somebody like Peter Schiff, who can give a brilliant 90-minute talk spontaneously with no notes. Whatever it is, I love to be in the presence of somebody like that. Well, it's not much notice, but tomorrow, March 24th, 2016, Daniel Levis, one of the world's great email marketers and a libertarian, is holding a webinar where he's going to teach you some of the fundamentals of email marketing. You're going to learn a ton, and believe it or not, on a subject like email marketing, you are going to be spellbound. If you are in the business of selling things, you have to attend this webinar. And I've got the sign-up link very easy for you, tomwoods.com/Daniel. You cannot miss this. There's no replay. It's Thursday, March 24th, 2016. He is the master, and you're going to be blown away. tomwoods.com/Daniel. Okay, the Republican Convention 2012, there are some Ron Paul delegates there, and Ron himself, was not entirely happy about what went on and all that. But your experience, I'm curious to know your own observations, and also I read something about how there were a few people who joined you in doing security who then became Ron Paul supporters?
Yeah, that's correct, Tom. Again, what happened was I needed they asked me, how many people do you need? So I said total I would like seven people at least. The three of us, that me, Will Gallagher, and Jonathan Schaefer. And then I added on, if I could name their names real quick, Joe Guida, Louis Robles, Mickey Schneider, and Dick Terrio, who are all from, all cops. I can't tell you, it was like overnight. They were Ron Paul. No, don't talk about Mitt Romney. Don't talk about anybody else. They're Ron Paul people. And in fact, they weren't really into politics at all. And now to this day, they still are into politics. And they're like, Ron Paul, where's Ron Paul? And it's amazing that, these are kind of crusty old cops, detectives. And they changed, and they believed it. I'm talking about being true believers too, not just liking them. They love them. But true believers in his message, because they heard his speech, they heard him talking, and it was just wonderful, that experience, that part of it.
That is incredible. I mean, that I always love when somebody gets, sort of turned on to the message, but that's really fantastic, right? Especially given the location. What was your overall impression of what was going on at the convention?
Well, actually, it was kind of I was with Ron all the time, so I wasn't really in touch with what was going on. What I found out later, I found out a lot later what had happened, because I didn't really know exactly what was going on with this rule change thing and buses were not getting there. I mean, I heard about that later, but I was with Ron most of the time. They had some speeches he had to make. We had to take him to different locations, but the only time that I really came into contact with anything like firsthand with him was when we went to the RNC. And in fact, they didn't treat him very well there. And I was very upset because in order to get into the place, you had to go through a magnetometer, they wave you down with metal detectors and that's fine. They do it to everybody, but they don't do it to the congressman and so forth. But Ron had to wait there, and for some reason he was waiting there. And I just felt like, this is not right. So I went up and I talked to somebody, and finally we were able to get through instead, because I thought it was just wrong of them to like delay his entry onto the floor. So then finally we got inside, and here's a story I'm going to add on to this just a little bit here.
Yeah, sure.
As we went inside, we toured, around the arena, the areas where they usually have concessions and stuff. And they had a Fox thing, and he did an interview with Neil Cavuto. And then after that interview, he went into a waiting room before he went to the floor. And as I was opening the door to look outside, here comes somebody there's only really one person in this entire world that I can probably say I can't stand. That's Bill Kristol.
Oh.
And Bill Kristol, I saw him coming through trying to go into the same door. And Ron's in the room now. So I was like, no, this is not your area, sir. I was polite. And I didn't want to, I'm be honest with you, I didn't want to be polite. The cop in me almost came out, but I let it go. But, that was amazing enough. And then finally we got down onto the floor, and it erupted into, everybody was cheering, the Ron Paul people, Ron went around, and I'll tell you one thing about Ron is when he was there, he went to all the congregations, you know, and met with the people on the floor. But Iowa was in a bus stuck somewhere, I think. So he looking, he was saying, John, or he would say to me, John, or Jonathan was this other guy. He would say, Jonathan, you know, where are the Iowa guys? So we would try to find that out, and we couldn't find it out because they weren't there. And Ron was, you know, quite stunned that the Iowa people weren't there at the time. And I think that was the time that they were stuck in the bus. But that that time on the floor, Ron went out, and then he found out that he missed, I think, Minnesota. So he decided, let's go back in. We're not going to miss Minnesota. So we went back in, and we got a chance to go over to the congregation, I guess, from Minnesota, and then we walked out. But I guess that's my RNC stuff. You know, I know there's plenty of stuff that went on, but being with Ron all the time, I was kind of, you know, I was out of the loop, really.
Yeah, no, I get that. But tell us a story about what happened when he and the family and everybody left the convention and they were trying to fly out of there.
Worst moment of the campaign for me, and I think probably for Ron, I don't know. What happened was a car ahead of me had the some family members, and we had car one and car two, and we would always have two cars. And anyway, I was in the car with Ron, and by the time we got there, I get a call before we got there. TSA is setting up, and they're starting to search the pilots. This is an executive private airport. At private airports now, you got to remember, for 15 months, I don't know how many hundreds of private airports that we went through. There's never TSA there because you're like pre-checked. They have like a thing they do for these private airports, you know, and you just go through. There's no TSA ever, ever. But here on this last day when he's leaving from the RNC, TSA sets up. So this put me in a tough situation because Ron is standing there with Carol and Linda. Linda also was part of our team, by the way. She did a great job. But Linda Paul, his granddaughter, she was there with him. And Ron, Tom, I can only say that I've never saw a face on Ron like that. Just not defeated, because he's never defeated. Ron will never be defeated. But just, I don't know, he was just so downtrodden. And, you know, Carol was very upset. And then the guy asked, a TSA guy in a suit and tie, which was unusual too, because you don't see a plainclothes TSA people usually. And this guy came over and he said, we're going to need your identification to Ron. So I was there, of course, with him, and my six other guys were there. And Ron opens up his wallet and like pulls out his driver's license. He's probably never taken it out before, you know. And he's handing it to the guy. And at that moment, Ron Paul was on the screen. They had a picture of Ron on the screen, the TV screen I was playing at the airport. So I showed the guy. I said, well, that's him. I mean, you know, if you need ID, that's him. He's like, well, I need this ID card, and we're going to have to pat them down. And in the meantime, as of this is happening, they are patting down the pilots. So I asked them politely, and not too sarcastically, but I said, you know, these guys are pilots. If they want to crash a plane, they can crash a plane. I mean, they're pilots.
Yeah.
So they didn't really. So at that point, I told my guys to stand at strategic positions because I was very much in a quandary. This is the toughest situation I was in with the campaign.
Yeah.
And I needed to know, you know, that I didn't want this to turn into something bad, but I wasn't going to have Ron and Carol search like that. It just was not going to happen on my watch. So what I did was I told everybody, stay where you are, and I'll direct you to what to do. We had headphones on and stuff. And, you know, everybody, we didn't smile. You know, we were always just kind of stoic or whatever. But anyway, I think to myself, I said, what am I going to do here? Because I had two choices. One is my guys stand off with the TSA and Ron and the pilots get on the plane and they leave. And Ron wouldn't like that. And I wouldn't like that. So that was like, well, that's not good. So then I said, well, you know, let me start taking pictures of this guy. Just politely, because I didn't say anything really to him. And let's see what happens. And I started taking photos of him and you know, close-ups. And within, I mean this time, within like 2 minutes, and my guys would back me up on this, this guy was on a cell phone. And he comes over to me a couple minutes later. He's like, okay, this is canceled. You can go on the plane.
Oh, my gosh.
So my guys, so then we saw them off until the plane took off. And you know, I remember going up to Ron and saying, you know, sir, the the phone is like a new gun, kind of like, you know, because you could take pictures. I think Judge Napolitano said that. So I said, that's what I figured we were doing. And then he got off on the plane. He wasn't, obviously, was, I don't think he was very happy. And Carol certainly wasn't, and Linda wasn't. But I told my guys, I said, we are now going to walk out of here like men. We're going to keep our mouths shut, and we're going to walk like men right to our cars and take off, because we were furious, but we wanted to. So we walked out of there like I wanted to say that, you know, I wanted to represent Ron Paul that we were, you know, we're not going to be run over, but, you know, it just, so we walked out, went to our cars, and we left, and that was it. But that was that situation. It was shameful. It was a total shame. And in fact, Mitt Romney's plane was sitting on that runway. And that's one of the reasons they gave me why they did it, which was ridiculous. But at that time, because the next day I read it in the paper, a Secret Service agent had left his gun in the bathroom, in the commode, in this jet, in Mitt Romney's jet. I mean, he had like a 727, whatever it is, one of those big planes. And, you know, I said to myself, you know, well, we did better than the Secret Service. We did our job without stomping anybody's feet, without smashing anybody, without doing anything like that. And I was always hoped that Ron would be proud of us. You know, we all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, just to show you one thing, Tom, I know I don't want to ramble too much, but just to show you about the Secret Service, I got along with them. You know, I did. But when there was a glitter, and everybody's getting glittered at some point, I don't know who was glittering. They throw glitter on them, the candidates. Well, Mitt Romney, while he had Secret Service protection, got glittered like they dumped the whole bucket on his head. Now, when we had Ron, somebody tried to throw glitter, and I guess we were doing our jobs right, because it hit me and it hit Jonathan and it hit Will, who I was working with, and nothing hit Ron. And when we got out in the hallway and he looked at us, he goes, you know, you guys don't look too bad with that stuff on you. And we just started laughing. You know, there's nothing to do but laugh at that point. I could go, there's so much, Tom, that I could go into, but Ron changed my life, I have to say. I'm not just kind of pointing out something. He changed who I am, how I treat people, how he changed me. He did. You changed me too, but he changed me.
That's amazing. That really is amazing, because I could imagine watching his example, and the thing is that, John, sometimes I have to say there have been times when I've been frustrated that he wants to take the high road. You know, I want him to get in the mud and tell the truth about these other candidates, and I want him to do all these things, and it's just not him. And I, you know, eventually I came around to realize and respect that, and you know, so he changed my mind on things as well. But tell me about his other half, of course. Tell me about Carol. And she wasn't always on the trail with you, but when she was, what was she doing?
Oh, Carol was on the trail quite a bit at the second half of the campaign. I mean, she was on the trail a lot with Ron.
Okay.
Second half. 2008 was a different campaign, but 2012, she was on the campaign a lot. And what Carol was a fantastic speaker. And I guess at one point they used her to do an introduction of Ron at a fundraiser, and she was fantastic. I mean, she was a great speaker. She's funny, and it was just great. And she would go and introduce not me, but the campaign, you know, and the people who were on the ground would use her to introduce Ron a lot. And she's just like a, you know her, but she's just such a wonderful woman.
Yeah,
and she can bring a little laugh to the crowd. And then Ron comes up. So Carol worked very hard with Ron. And Carol, I tell you, Carol was on top. You know these things. I'm for your listeners, I'm kind of trying to tell them. But Carol was on top of things. She wasn't just somebody that, you know, sit to the side and, okay, you know, I don't know what's going on. She knew about these. She knew about stuff, you know. And it was wonderful to be around her as well. In fact, I always say, apart from my own mother and father, you know, Carol and Ron changed my life more than, you know, any two people in the world. And, you know, I was blessed to have that assignment, Tom. I was blessed.
Yeah. It must've been thrilling. Cause I remember every time I would see you on TV, I would say, you know, darn it, I got to ask this guy when he gets back about some of his stories. And then, you know, I really started to cut back on my heavy travel schedule, which is much better for the family, if for me not to be gone all the time. So, but that meant that I didn't see you as much. I haven't seen you since, I think, the end of the campaign. So this is my first time to really find out about it. So you guys even ran into, at one point, you ran into the Occupy Wall Street crowd. Now, where was that?
That was in Iowa, actually. I remember, I don't remember the exact name of the place, but anyway, it was at a location in Iowa. We had a few hundred people in the crowd. And the Iowa guys, who I always got along with, the grassroots guys in Iowa, I got along with them very well. I think highly of them. And they actually came up and they were very concerned about it, you know, and I understood why. But I had studied them, you know, being on the trail. I wasn't just all, you know, just aloof. You know, I knew what was going on Occupy Wall Street. I knew kind of what they were about, what they were going to do. So this was one of the few times that Ron actually, because he needed to, asked for my counsel. And, you know, to me, that's a huge, you know, compliment. And I said, I think you can handle it, sir. And we certainly can handle it. And Ron said, okay. And he went out on stage. And at some point, they started their chant. They would do this chant and hold up the signs. And he let them do their chant. And he said, isn't it great that we have the First Amendment? And everybody kind of laughed. And then he addressed some of their issues, you know, some Occupy Wall Street's issues. He addressed them. And that was it. There was no further incident. I mean, nothing. And so there were really, Ron knew how to, and he was never, ever afraid to go out to a crowd or anything. There was only one time that we really had to get off stage because the crowd was getting so big that people were getting crushed in the front, almost like a rock concert. And I had to take one little boy and pick him up and put him up the stage. And we conferred, both Ron and I looked at each other and I said, sir, I think we need to get off, you know, the stage at this point. It's getting a little dangerous. And of course, you know, Ron immediately, boom, we're off the stage. But we didn't want to see anybody crushed. But that's the amount of people. I mean, we're talking from 50 to at the Sundome, about 11,000 people there. It was just amazing. And I feel, you know, I'm proud of my guys and my two guys, Will Gallagher and John Schaefer, who I work with, because the three of us handled what probably 150 or 200 Secret Service people would do. And, you know, they work shifts and everything. But we loved it. There was never a minute that I didn't love it. And never a minute that I didn't think to myself, boy, am I the luckiest guy in the world? You know, here I am sitting next to a guy who's like Thomas Jefferson to me. And whenever I had have a conversation with him every once in a while about, you know, I kept them in my mouth shut quite often. But you know, once in a while we would talk, you'd ask me about my family or something, or we talk about the Constitution. And that's when I really got excited. You know me, Tom, I'm very, you know, I love to learn about the Constitution. And I remember we talked about the Kelo decision at one point. And, you know, it was like a highlight of my constitutional life, right? You know?
Kelo
decision with Ron Paul, you know?
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I was, and the incorporation doctrine, stuff like that, you know. But, you know, it was just, I just say that I was very fortunate and blessed that I got to be able to work with him and with the people that surrounded him.
Totally, totally thrilling. I still got a couple more things I want to ask you.
Oh, ask. Sure.
Tell me about the near-death traffic incident.
Oh, well, this was, and when I say near death, I mean near death. And the reason we say near death, I would say something else probably, but because Ron said it afterwards. Because what happened was we were in Kansas City somewhere. And we were going across a bridge that had a barrier in between the lanes, you know, of course, the oncoming traffic and whatever. And they were two, like, cement barriers. And all of a sudden, just out of the corner of my eye, I see this truck, a white, like, van, barreling over the two barriers right towards us. And I said, Jonathan, to Jonathan Schaefer, my driver. And he somehow miraculously pulled that car. And in back of me, we had car two, which Carol was in, and Linda, with Will Gallagher, who was our driver, and somehow, miraculously, we both swerved out of the way, and that car came over, and the wheel came off it. I could see from behind, and it stopped, and I didn't see any, you know, further accident. We, you know, just went on then at that point when we didn't see any further accident. If we saw something, though, that, I mean, that was very scary, and Ron said, geez, he probably did say gee whiz. Gee whiz, that was I say what in the thunder, you know?
Yeah. When he almost dies, he gets excited enough to say gee whiz.
Yeah. And I stupidly get up like at the time, and I'm like standing up in the front, like I'm gonna block something. Like a car's coming at me and somehow I'm gonna block this van from getting in the back seat. It's ridiculous. It was ridiculous
to
me.
But I didn't,
that was a reaction. But it was very, very scary. You know, at that point. But we, you know, I laugh now, but at the time it was not laughable. It was very, we were very, very lucky, very blessed.
Well, you had another thing in traffic on, I guess, Ventura Boulevard.
Yeah.
With a suicidal guy.
Yeah, Tom, it was, I think, I-5. I'm not sure, not that great with L.A., but I think it was I-5, that main highway. And it was an exit ramp right off onto Ventura Boulevard. And if you made a right, we were staying, Ron and us, we were all staying at that hotel there. There was a hotel there. And as we pulled down on the exit ramp, we hit the stoplight. I saw this guy, and Jonathan saw him too, and so did Will. And he was trying to push himself into traffic. And he had, like, I think his legs were amputated or whatever. And we looked at each other, and we knew somebody got to do it. So I said, okay, guys, can you take him over to the hotel, and I'll take care of this. So they took Ron to the hotel, and I went out, and I was on this exit ramp in this, you know, it's like New York City in the highway, you know. Everybody's going by. So I pulled out my old shield, we call it a shield in New York. My detective shield, my gold detective shield, I'm holding it out, trying hopefully nobody hits me. And I get over to this guy, and I reach down, I talk to him. And I kind of expected maybe it was an intoxicated male or whatever. But this man was from, this is very, it was very sad. I mean, this guy was from finally got him to tell me he was from he was in a cancer, like a hospice situation. And he just wanted to kill himself. So I was like, well, listen, not today. So I managed to get him with some onlooker saw me holding my shield up, came over, and we managed to pull him to safety. I called 911. And what I did was, if you'll kind of get a little laugh out of this, Tom, I called 911 and I said, I'm a retired detective from New York. We have this guy. He just needs an ambulance, you know, and that's what he needs. And I waited till the ambulance came on the scene. But the wrong thing for me to do was to get on the air and say I was a retired NYPD detective, because no matter what people think of LA detectives, LAPD in general, there were 6 LAPD cars there within, like, you know, minutes. And I just booked. I just got away because they, you know, there's kind of a unwritten rule between LAPD and NYPD. You know, if I call, they're going to be there. So, you know, that was an interesting incident. I never asked Ron about it. He never mentioned it. And, you know, I didn't expect him to, because he's that type of man. But we've had so many interesting times, and it was dangerous times, but also funny times. And I could just add the one about the sleeveless rabbit fur coat. Could I do that, Tom?
Please. I would be disappointed if you didn't mention that.
Okay. Well, we were also, this was another fundraiser, and there was a gentleman there who actually had an online business, and he sold these sleeveless, some were rabbit fur, some were, I don't know, leather, or some were fur. I think it was all kinds of fur. And they were supposed to be worn without a shirt on. You know, I don't ask me. I don't know how these things work, fashion or whatever. But anyway, he came over to Ron and he gave him this rabbit fur sleeveless, like, jacket. And so Ron takes it. He makes sure he's got it. He gives it to Linda. Linda always took care of stuff. And we get in the car. We finish from that. We get in the car and we're going to the hotel. And as we go out of the car to the hotel, we're always checking around, make sure that Ron gets everything. And you never carry anything for him, heaven forbid, because he carries everything himself. You don't carry anything for Ron. He takes care of his own luggage. But we always check. He had his jacket with him. So he said, oh, I forgot my jacket. I said, sir, you have it right there. He goes, no, the other one. And we rush back to the car and we get this rabbit fur jacket. And we're trying to hold a little bit of a laugh in. Not at Ron, but, you know, kind of at the situation, and Linda too. And he loved this rabbit fur jacket. He took it upstairs, apparently. And, you know, nobody's going to get this, but Linda Paul has a photo of Ron wearing that. I don't think he was I think he had a shirt on, but Linda Paul had a photo of this. I never saw it, and I don't think anybody's going to see it. But but I thought that was a pretty funny incident, you know. There's so many of them.
I'm sure the stories are just endless. But when the campaign came to an end, you know, I mean, I guess you were there right to the very end. I mean, were you there when he? I mean, did he say thank you and goodbye to everybody? I mean, how did it? Well,
yes,
how did it all end?
He said he of course, when we were at the airport, you know, we had enough time. He said goodbye to all of my, you know, my guys. But I had a feeling that, you know, he knew that he and I would meet again because there was an LPAC coming up in September.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's just what I do. I go up there and I do that with him. So it wasn't like a goodbye for us. But at one point, I will tell you, we were in Florida at a Liberty Summit down in Florida here. This is not the one you were at. It's another one. And the one you were at, by the way, was the greatest one. But
I wasn't going to say it.
It was the greatest one. Tom Woods, Brian McClanahan, Kevin Gutzman, Tom DiLorenzo. I mean, he can't beat that. And I was in charge of speakers, by the way, Tom. So.
Oh, that's right. And who's that? Bruce Fine was there.
I mean,
I think Tom Mullen might have been there. It was a great group.
Tom Mullen was there. Yep.
Yeah.
Great lineup. But anyway, we were leaving that location, and he was pulling his bag, and I was walking along, and he stopped. This is like 6:30 a.m., you know, we're going to the airport. He stopped. He looked at me. He says, you know, when they told me I was going to get a security guy, he said, I never knew I would get somebody who got it, who understood, like, the Constitution.
Wow. Yeah.
And then he just walked on. But that's Ron's way. You know, he's like my dad. You know, he's old school. That's his way of saying thanks. You know, to me, what that made my life. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, you know, I had him on about a week ago, and I asked him only listener questions, and they had to be questions he hasn't answered a million times before. You know, so don't ask him, should I run for Congress or whatever. We already know what his answer is to that. So we asked him, for instance, what his morning routine was. And he says, you know, now that he's at home, he does, you know, he walks 4 miles a day in the morning, and then he comes back and gets ready for his day. And then in the afternoon, he rides his bike. Now, all right, maybe he can't tote his bike around on the campaign trail, but was he always awake early in the morning?
Oh, yes.
I mean, did you ever go out for a walk with him, or was that always by himself?
Well, sometimes he would sneak out on us. He knew that we needed to be with him, but sometimes at 6 a.m. he woke up, he would go out and get a little bit of breakfast at the breakfast bar at a hotel where we were staying, and then he would go out for a walk. And usually we would have our totally in shape Jonathan go walking with him, and sometimes he would take him out. Jonathan would actually go out hiking with him. You know, take him when nobody knew where he was going. And this was in Vegas. And they hiked, I think on, I don't know where they hiked. You know, I'm not a hiker, but outdoorsman. But anyway, they hiked, and he always wanted to get that walk in and that exercise. And we could never keep up with him. I mean, we had a bunch of guys and some real young guys too. And nobody could ever really keep up with him. I mean, he walked so fast. I mean, it was really amazing. But yeah, he did. I listened to that podcast, by the way. And yeah, you know, seeing him, I know I heard one of his family members saying that, you know, one day they were riding along down on Lake Jackson, and there's Ron riding along on his bicycle, you know, and, you know, he's all over. Like, so he has that routine. I think that's great. And it's rubbed off on me a bit, too, you know, how he does stuff.
I want to share one story with you, actually, before we wrap up. This is from the 2008 campaign. You remember the Revolution March that was held out in front of the Capitol building? I don't know if you were there,
but I wasn't.
But you know about it, yeah. And you can you know, find the all the talks on YouTube and everything. Well, the night before that, there was a little bit of a pre-Revolution March party at a bar. A lot of the people who were in town for the march figured we'd go to a bar and have a party. Well, I had the good fortune of a few of us had dinner with Dr. Paul at a Ruby Tuesday in town. And the two things I love about this were, first of all, you know, the people on the restaurant staff all saying to each other, we know that's Ron Paul over there. What do we do? they eventually all got a picture with him and everything. And there were people in the restaurant who came up to him. And I thought, you know, this must happen to him all the time. But anyway, it was I knew where the if you want to know where the party is, you ask Woods, right?
Right.
I mean, who else would you ask? So I knew this thing was going on. It was almost 10 o'clock, and we were wrapping up to leave the restaurant, and I said, you know, there is a pre-Revolution March party going on down at such and such place, and wouldn't it be unbelievable? I was talking to Dr. Paul. If you made a surprise appearance, like, no one in the world is expecting you to be at a bar right now. And he looked at his watch. It was 10 p.m. and he jokingly said, "Are people still awake at this hour?" so he agreed to do it. So we drove over there. We walked down the side. We walked down the street. Of course, people are looking. It's Ron Paul walking down the street. When he walked into that bar, it was like the thing was going to collapse from the people screaming and cheering. And they, I mean, the last person in the world you expect to see is Ron Paul, because we know, you know, he's an early to rise, early to bed, probably doesn't drink a whole lot. And right. there he was. It was this just the best. And somebody somehow had like a bullhorn or something. They handed it to him and he's giving an impromptu speech. People are trying to film it with their smartphones because they just can't believe this is happening. And this is also on YouTube, too. I just thought this is the most awesome thing in the world. I never in a million years thought he'd agree. I thought he'd say, yeah, that's funny. Now I'm going to bed. He went. It was incredible.
That's Ron. You know, Ron, and I know
you
Ron
can't
too.
Predict what he's going to do sometimes.
Can't. And he's just, and it's just wonderful. I mean, really, when you talk about the stories, most of them, the stories are wonderful. I mean, you know, and, you know, I wouldn't have traded this for anything in the world.
Yeah, these are memories you'll just cherish forever. Well, John, we're so glad that you came here to share a bunch of them with us. You know, I'm sure you cherish the memories, and we very, very much enjoyed getting a chance to be a little bit of a part of them after the fact. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everybody. Before I let you go, let me tell you a little something about John Baeza's forthcoming website. It will be available at nypdtruth.com. He says, I review the following cases for the defense and, rarely, the prosecution. I look for the truth. I specialize in these areas. Rape, homicide, child abuse, false reports, false arrests, unreliable criminal profiles, and criminal investigative procedure. I accept other cases for analysis as well. So that'll be up soon, nypdtruth.com. Tomorrow, by popular demand, if all goes well, Christina Hoff Summers will join us on the show. That's going to be a great conversation as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.